Sexton trying to get loose. He'll fire.
He knocks it down.
But Carl slammed it home. Garland upstairs.
Oh!
Sexton inside. Oh. A thunderous dunk.
And Allen blocked the shot at the rim.
Welcome to Chase Down Podcast, part of the Cavs Media family. I'm your host, Justin Rowan. Support for this podcast and the following message comes from Zoom. 500,000 businesses connect using Zoom, a single platform for phone, chat, workspaces, events, apps, and video. Zoom enables real-time collaboration for teams around the globe. Zoom, how the world connects. And connecting with me now, live via Zoom, is my co-host, Carter Rodriguez. Carter, how you doing, buddy?
Doing good. It's been a very productive morning. Changed my shower head out, Woo. Mowed the lawn, organized the garage. I had a real dad day.
Really sounds like it, man. And thanks for asking how I'm doing. I'm doing terrific, much better than the last podcast where I was.
Yeah, how's the tooth, my friend?
It's doing a little better. I was in an unbelievable amount of pain last time we did this. I am on antibiotics. I'm on T3, so if I'm a little loopy, it is what it is. But I'll be getting that taken care of on Monday finally. So I'm very excited to get that monkey off of my back.
Well, that's nice. I'm happy for you, bud. You play through pain like the best of them. No one knew you were hurting but me. That's a testament to your intense professionalism that I will never ever have.
And on this time with the stream, I won't be putting cold water in my mouth every few seconds to calm my tooth down. So that's at least a plus. But we got to start off with some unfortunate news for Cavs fans. Scotty Barnes won Rookie of the Year in the closest finish the award has seen since they changed to this format. We've talked about this a few times already throughout this year. This rookie class is unbelievable. There's no denying that Scotty Barnes put up a Rookie of the Year caliber year, along with Cade Cunningham, I would add. Obviously, a little bit disappointing. This was something that we kind of were at least worried about or could see the path to it when you hear a lot of the, I guess, voters that made their reasoning public were citing that the fact that the Raptors did pass the Cavs in the standings down the stretch, and given how close this race was, the edge kind of seemed to go towards him, especially with Mobley missing some time. Ultimately, it's frustrating. I don't necessarily agree with all of the logic, but this isn't a situation where it went to an undeserving candidate. So it's going to be a limited amount of outrage from me. Just another chip to throw on the old shoulder. We'll see how Raptors fans manage to spin this into American media hating them once again, because I'm sure they'll find a way. But congratulations to Scotty Barnes, but I'm excited to see what this extra little bit of motivation does for Evan Mobley.
Yeah, I mean, I think ultimately this one I'm having a hard time getting worked up over. One, we were both super duper high on Scotty Barnes, and we're super duper right that he's awesome. So that always helps.
Always feels better when we're
being right is awesome. I'll tell you what, guys, you should try it sometimes. So there's that. There's the fact that he's an objectively fun player who had an objectively great year on an objectively very good team who got hot at the right time and earned their way into the playoffs. Now, obviously, he had some significant bona fides around him, guys like Pascal Siakam, Fred VanVleet, NBA champions. But he had a great year. So to that end, it's hard to get worked up. Now, and here's the real reason why you don't get worked up. Ain't nobody on earth think that this dude is better than Evan Mobley at basketball.
Not if they're being honest. I mean, Masai would swap these guys. He'd probably give up some picks if he had to. That's why they were trying to trade up prior to the draft. I mean, if one were to be petty, they would point out that when the Raptors overtook the Cavs and, made up ground over January, February, March, and then finally in April, they were significantly better with Scotty Barnes off the floor, despite not having a bench in January, February, and March. A petty person would bring that up, Carter, but I think
it's... Yeah, and I also think the other, again, I don't need to make the case because I'm just not that passionate about it. I do think, a lot of people say that the advanced numbers favor Scotty a little bit more, but you also have to I know a stat that was kind of thrown against Evan late in the race is that the defense kind of fell apart without Jared on the floor. And there is one way to interpret that, which is that, Evan needs Jarrett to anchor the defense for him. The other interpretation is, if Jarrett's not playing, Lowry, Markkanen, and Kevin Love are playing a lot more minutes, and the defense is going to get worse.
Right, so, and also when you look at it, Jared Allen with Evan Mobley off the floor, it was an equivalent drop-off of the defense, right? Like, this isn't a situation where there's five very good defenders on the court at all times. Mobley and Allen were making up for a lot, and as you said, like, it's something that's frustrating. We said before the year that it would be tough for Mobley to win Rookie of the Year because his impact is likely going to go beyond the box score. And I think the fact that he got as much attention as he did just shows what next level impact that he has as a rookie beyond the box score. Like, people appreciate it. They saw it. It led to the massive turnaround that we saw with the Cavs this year. I think he was one of the biggest factors. And when you look at it, one of the gambles the Cavs made coming into the season was moving on from Larry Nance Jr., who was kind of that high impact guy. And for Evan Mobley to not only come in and make up for what Nance was bringing to the table and do even more within a very similar role, I feel great about it. Like, I'm not going to feel a moment of regret having Evan Mobley on the court and having him on the Cavs, because in my mind, like, he was still very clearly the player that I thought they were getting in the draft. And
I think he is more.
And he was even further ahead of schedule than I expected. So yeah, I'm excited about it. And it's not worth getting too worked up over. I got my jokes off, but at the end of the day, we got the better player. So I'm okay with
that. Yeah. If there were a real groundswell that, you know, like, from people who really thought that Barnes' ceiling was higher, et cetera, like, that's when maybe I'd get into arguments and fights online. But, like, it just feels so silly to do it. Like, everyone kind of knows why Scottie Barnes won this award. And, you know, I saw a great tweet. Someone tweeted at me and they said something along the lines of, you know, Scottie deserved it. Didn't mean he deserved it more than Evan.
Yep.
But he did deserve it, you know, much like Cade Cunningham deserved it. And, you know, it's just such a fun rookie class that it's just hard to get mad when, like, I think we got the best player. And also, like, it's just more ammo for, you know, if we were worried about this Cavs team resting on their laurels, I do think they're going to get shut out during award season. Mm-hmm. I don't think Darius is going to win most improved. Evan didn't win rookie of the year, and I don't think Kevin's going to win sixth man of the year.
Yeah, and I don't think JB's going to win coach of the year either, right?
I mean, he wasn't a top three.
That makes sense.
Go-getter.
So that's probably a safe bet.
He definitely did not win coach of the year. We can confirm that. And, like, I think to some extent, like, one, you do kind of dig your own grave when you finish as terribly as the Cavs did down the stretch. Obviously, all the reasons are very clear as to why they did, but it's really hard to overcome that, you know, that kind of sentiment of, like, no one's, like, rushing to vote for a Cavalier right now, given how their year ended. But, like, I think it is more kind of ammo and more motivation. Like, I just think that, like, if there was a thing to be worried about with this season, at least, you know, a month or two ago, is that they might come out fat and happy to start next year. And, like, the way the year ended, the way they're going to get likely blocked out of all the award races, I think they should come out pretty hungry.
Yeah, I think that's going to be very helpful, and we'll get into that a little later in this podcast when we kind of project a little bit to next season. But before we make it to next season, there is the off season, and we all know that the NBA year never ever stops. So I thought it'd be a good time while we're still getting situated. I've started my draft prep. I've started looking at guys, but before we dive into all of that, I thought it'd be a good time for us to kind of lay out our biggest questions about the Cavs offseason as we head into it. And my biggest question, I'll start this off here, Carter. It doesn't even necessarily have to directly do with the Cavs, but it has to do with the NBA landscape as a whole, because the Cavs have been very opportunistic throughout the last couple of years of capitalizing on when there is movement. When teams are looking to make moves, Kobe Altman has got in as a third team. He's helped facilitate kind of win-win trades. I mean, the Larry Nance Jr. one is a great example. Larry was what Portland needed. Unfortunately, their season fell apart and they moved him on to New Orleans. But Lauri Markkanen ended up being a better fit and filled the role the Cavs had for him better. So the Cavs have been very opportunistic finding those win-win moves. And I'm curious what opportunities are going to become available to them. Because I look around the NBA landscape. You look at the Phoenix Suns. They've already paid Chris Paul, Devin Booker, Mikal Bridges, and likely will max DeAndre Ayton. If they do, given
and
how...
And boy, did he look to earn it. 28-17 on 20 shots last night. My God.
Right. And the Suns were cost conscious, let's call it that, when they didn't extend Ayton to begin with this past offseason. If they do max Ayton, what does that mean for Cam Johnson? Are the Suns willing to pay the price that's going to come? Is that an opportunity for the Cavs? If the Utah Jazz blow things up, is Bogdanovich available? If the Charlotte Hornets start looking to off salary, what does that mean for maybe Gordon Hayward's availability? Not someone that we are big fans of off the court, but would potentially address a Cavs need, and the Cavs have a lot of expiring contracts. Like, you look at San Antonio. There were DeJounte Murray rumors at the trade deadline. Does Popovich stay there? And if he doesn't, what does that mean for the direction of the team?
Yeah, do they want to lock in on an expensive, just okay core?
Exactly. And my favorite one, Carter, is the Detroit Pistons. Because if you had to describe me, how would you go about doing that? You would call me a truth seeker and someone that's a critical thinker. And this truth seeker...
Is that what I would do?
Yeah, that's exactly what you do. This truth seeker, Carter, he's looking at Jeremy Grant, who was rumored at the trade deadline. We talked about how, while he fits, you kind of worry about the noise that he wants to be a lead option. But the team that he always gets connected to seems to be the Portland Trailblazers with Simons and Damian Lillard. This critical thinker, Carter, makes me wonder if that is accurate. And if he's willing to play with those guys, would he be willing to play with Sexland? Because that is a guy that I would have a lot of interest in and might merit some digging from the Cavs' behalf. Because I find him to be a really interesting player, someone that would give them some versatilities. And if he was willing to buy into this and not be the only front court player that plays defense... that could be an interesting fit. So there may be other opportunities that I didn't outline here in this rant, but that's going to be the biggest thing for me, is what opportunities become available because teams have different agendas than the Cavs have right now.
Yeah, I mean, a guy like Grant is looking increasingly interesting to me, just because of his ability to play two-way ball and at the three or the four. Mm-hmm. Definitely a little overstated as a perimeter lockdown guy. But, can do the job against big wings, can slide up to the four and hold his own defensively in a way Lowry can't. That's kind of and Lowry was admirable. He's just not the defender, an athletic athlete that Jeremy Grant is, who is a freak. But yeah, I think in general it's a good point and it's a good question, which is basically, in the macro, what teams are going to do weird stuff?
Yeah.
And how willing is JB to get in on it? Or I'm sorry, Kobe to get in on it, where it was a lot. We've said this quite a bit. It was a lot easier to do Kobe Altman's job a year or two ago.
Mm-hmm.
He just had to win the asset battle and add positive value in trades. He has to be a lot smarter now. I think they won the Caris LeVert trade in the headlines, and I don't know if the fit has been perfect yet.
Yeah.
Now that doesn't mean it can't be, but all this to say, when you're trying to win, it gets a lot harder, to get into these deals. Everyone knows you're trying to win too, so they care a little bit more about what they're giving you. It's really easy to dump an asset on a team that you expect to win 26 games.
Yeah.
And especially within your own conference and within your own division.
Yeah. And I think the reason why this question jumped out to me and was one that I want to highlight on the pod is Cavs are in a very interesting situation. Like, if they run it back, they are bringing together a group that hasn't played together. Like, Caris LeVert, Colin Sexton, all these guys haven't played together. So I'm not in a rush to rock the boat. But at the same time, you have to be aware of what opportunities are out there, right? So they may feel like, hey, we're comfortable taking a patient approach, working on internal development, round out the rotation with a couple small signings. But if something becomes available, you have to be ready to jump on that. So that's why I'm very curious to see how this shakes out. Another big factor is the Cavs have so many expiring contracts. When you look at Caris LeVert, you look at Kevin Love, you look at even functionally Jetty Osman, like there's a lot of non-guaranteed money beyond just this next year. And they also have a lottery pick for the probably the last time in a long time, hopefully. So they're in a very, very unique situation where they can go a lot of different directions. I'm perfectly fine with running it back. But at the same time, you got to evaluate all the opportunities and make an informed decision.
Yeah. Do you think the value of expiring contracts might be on the kick up a little bit?
Because yes, yes,
because no. it does feel like some more teams are you're hearing more talk about teams that are feeling the cap squeeze lately.
Mm-hmm.
And you're also seeing more teams that blow up. And like one thing that is really valuable with the Cavs expirings, if you did decide to move them, is those are the if Utah, for example, decides to blow things up. Getting a decent expiring contract player back that both has a good matching number and is a decent on-court player is really valuable because you can double dip.
That's the biggest thing. Like Caris LeVert is extension eligible. Kevin Love, you know that he brought a lot to the table this year. Jetty Osman for a role player. Like I know people get frustrated with Jetty, and I think some of what happened with Jetty is similar to like Isaac Okoro when the rotation got thinner and thinner. They were asked to do more and more and things fell apart. But at the end of the day, like he is a valuable player on the reported contract that he has. He's someone that did make a difference for the team. Like all three of those guys in particular are guys that not only are expiring contracts, but are helpful players. So I do think that puts the Cavs in an interesting position where maybe open some doors that you wouldn't think would be open to begin with.
Awesome. Can I do my first big question?
Go for it, buddy.
Which lessons is Kobe Altman going to choose to learn from?
Because I like that question.
There are a lot of takeaways at the end of the season, and and it's very easy just to say that they're all black and white, but they're not.
Mm-hmm.
Each choice you make has down the line impact. I think about the backup five, okay? So that was a lesson I hope he takes away is, hey, I need to actually, I should be rostering a backup five that can play minutes for me when it counts. Now, he can choose to learn that lesson, quote-unquote, and make an action, but there are down roster implications. It gets really hard to play Kevin Love and Lauri Markkanen in their minutes at the four. When Evan Mobley suddenly goes from playing 15 to 20 minutes at the five a game to zero.
Yeah.
So like, does he actually think that's a problem? If they go draft a wing and then maybe go sign another one with a mid-level exception. Okay. That might be a lesson you learn, which is, or a takeaway that you have, which is, hey, this team needs more wing help. But where does Isaac Okoro get his minutes then? Are you ready to knock Isaac Okoro out of the rotation or move Lowry to the bench to play? And then what does that do to Kevin Love? There's all these different implications and things that you can kind of choose to take away based on kind of how the season ended, where things went a little bit adrift for the Cavs. And if you try to address all of them, you're going to squeeze out a lot of players who played well for you this year. Mm-hmm. And it's going to be really, really interesting to see how much he wants to tinker with a formula that worked pretty darn well this year.
You're tempting me to name this podcast because of the implication.
Implication.
Yeah, you know, the choice is there though, Carter. I think that's a really interesting point because you're right. Like there were things that were exposed down the stretch. Like the interesting thing is you come into a season, you go through training camp and you have your base sets that you run, right? Like, and I thought the Cavs showed variety in their offense. I thought there was a lot of interesting things they did at the start of the year. And typically what happens is as young guys and as the team gets more comfortable with it, you add to that, right? Like you start adding more wrinkles, you throw more things in. And the Cavs were forced to go the other direction, right? Where once Sexton and Rubio went down, you can't add more kind of wrinkles of multiple ball handlers. So you simplify a little bit. And then Jared Allen goes down and things kept getting taken off the table. So instead of building on what they were doing offensively, you had to take things away. And I think you've been right on the money here when you're talking about bringing in a center, because maybe your ability to run that type of offense is no longer reliant on just one player being Jared Allen. And maybe Evan Mobley improves in that area as well, and that opens things up. Like, there's a whole bunch of implications depending on what move you make here. But I do think that it's a really interesting question. No matter what you do, when you have this many guys that you feel comfortable being in a rotation, like, if you make a move, there is going to be ripple effects. Some things are going to be put on the table and some things are going to be taken off. So that's why I really like kind of the framing you have with this question.
Yeah. It's just we are past the simple solution part of the roster building equation. And again, it is really easy to say they need to do X, Y, and Z. But it's much harder when you account for how that affects what was a formula that took the third youngest starting lineup in the league to 44 win season.
Yeah. And it ties into my second question, which is, what is the plan for the small forward position? Because I think, especially when you look at the playoffs and try to take some lessons from it, you see teams do a very good job of taking away what teams do. And you have to be able to play multiple styles. You have to be able to make those kinds of adjustments, both from a schematic standpoint and also from a personnel standpoint. Like, I thought it was interesting that Doc Rivers basically isn't playing Thibault in this series because he understands he's only going to have him for the home games, right? Like, there's all sorts of adjustments. Memphis taking Steven Adams off the court, even though he's been one of their more impactful players throughout the year. Like, there's all sorts of things that teams do. And my question is what the plan for the small forward position is for the Cavs, because we know Lauri Markkanen and Tall Ball works for the Cavs. But at the same time, you saw against Atlanta that certain teams can figure things out, especially when you have a player as talented as Trae Young. Some of the switching, the Lauri Markkanen on guards is a little bit different. And they didn't really have the versatility to put someone else in that position. It'd be nice to have Dean Wade there, and maybe that answers some of those problems. But even like Lamar Stevens, who is a very good defensive player against forwards, when he starts getting against these shifty guards, he does get foul happy and can be exposed a little bit in those ways. So my question is, do they address a small forward position? And if they do, whether it be through the draft, trades, free agency, what implications that has? Because even if Lauri Markkanen is still playing meaningful minutes at the three, and I think that's a look, as long as he's on the roster, I think that's a look that I'd like to keep going back to at times. If someone is eating up more minutes at the three, what does that mean for Kevin Love? Because if Lowry's going to deserve minutes on this team no matter what. And if you do have a defensive three, it probably makes it easier to play Lowry at the four. And with Kevin Love being an expiring contract, you have to answer these questions of, can we afford to have both Lauri Markkanen and Kevin Love on this roster? And this is one of those tough spots where, from an emotional standpoint, from a fan standpoint, like I've said, I want Kevin Love to be on this roster as long as he wants to be. But at the same time, you have to be practical about this. And I could understand the rationale of, okay, if we need to prioritize one, it might be the younger player in Lauri Markkanen. Or you might say, hey, if Kevin Love is willing to stay here long-term on a value contract after next year, and we need to do things at the small forward to change our versatility, the way that we construct our lineups, maybe we gauge what the trade value of Lowry is. Like, these are things that I'm really grateful that I am not the one that has to make these decisions. I have a tendency to fall in love with the guys that got me here, and that's just the way that I am. But I do think that it's an important question that the team is going to have to ask itself.
Yeah. I mean, and, you know, I do think it's less of a question if it's through the draft, because the reality is, even though it is a lottery pick, it's the end of the lottery.
Yeah.
And I think right now it is much less likely that assuming everyone's back, assuming Colin is re-signed and everyone's healthy, which, you know, this is why you have depth, because at no point has everyone been healthy very often for the Cavs the last couple of years. But I'm not sure that whoever they draft is going to be in the rotation on day one.
I agree with that. Especially if Caris LeVert is back as well.
Caris is under contract, so I'm assuming he's going to be back unless some transactions are made. So if Colin comes back, and I know we'll talk about that in a minute, all of a sudden you got Darius, Colin, Caris, Lowry, Evan, Jarrett,
mm-hmm.
Kevin Love, Isaac Okoro.
Jetty's still under contract.
Yeah, you hit nine really, really fast, and I don't think that JB Bickerstaff is a 10-man rotation kind of coach. I just don't think he is.
And Dean Wade and Lamar Stevens have shown that they can definitely handle minutes. Now, Dean Wade, it might be a bit of a question mark with the whole meniscus situation. You don't know if he's going to be right for the start of camp. I don't know how that's going to play out, but you're right. I would like to be a 9-10-man rotation. I'd like to get that many players that JB can trust and, you know, just play a little bit more like Memphis, where you feel confident in your depth and you don't overextend anybody too much. Because I think you see, even with a team like Toronto that's basically playing a playoff rotation all year, guys wore down over the course of the year, and you don't have that extra gear when you come to playoffs and you shorten the rotation, right? I think ideally that's the way that you'd want to go. And I think to start the year, when Colin and Ricky were there, you saw a little bit of that. But even looking back on it, when the 10 and a half games that we had Sexton, you lost Garland for two, you lost Okoro for a bunch of those, and Lowry and Love also missed time with COVID during that stretch. Even at the start of the year, there wasn't the depth that you would have had if you had all of your guys, right? We are missing rotation players at every point of the year. So it's hard to even get a true feel of how deep in a rotation JB would go when he doesn't have the depth at any point of the season.
Yeah. I just think it's going to be a challenge in the end. And the guys who got us here are going to have first dibs at these spots. And, you know, that's why, you know, I think when we are talking about ways to address the position, I think both of us are really talking about consolidation kind of trades, where it's a two for one
prime.
Or three for one.
It feels
they have a lot of bodies that they trust right now.
And so, and they're going to have the MLE, I'm pretty sure. That could potentially bring in another player that is addressing a need, whether that be,
I know you got eyes on Nick Batum.
Derek Favors. This is going to be the off season where both of our crushes get brought in.
If we bring Howell Neto, I will be so happy.
Neto and Derek Favors. That's how it's going to happen, Carter. No, there's so many interesting ways to go, and ultimately these are good problems to have. And my favorite thing about these problems is I'm not the one that has to solve them. But I do think it's interesting.
Have to solve them?
I don't think so. I will take credit if one of the ideas that I threw against the wall in one of these podcasts pans out, the same way I did with Drummond. That didn't pan out too well. With Lowry, with Jared, with LeVert, again, didn't work out as well as I hoped. I will take some credit for it, but you know...
That's good.
But if the opportunity does come, let's say Detroit is fine swapping expiring contracts with one of our guys and the 14th pick for Jeremy Grant. And Grant is willing to buy into the situation. He's willing to extend with the Cavs and all that. If he's playing at the three, that gives massive implications for how you allocate playing time to Love and Lowry, right? There's just so many interesting ways that this can go, and really, really tough questions that the Cavs are going to have to answer.
Pretty dang exciting possibilities, though. I do want to move over to my second big question, which is, can Isaac Okoro become a 16-game player? AKA, for those unaffiliated with the terminology, can this dude play in the playoffs? Because, mm-hmm. The reality is, I actually think I was pretty disappointed by his play-in performance and the way it affected the team when he was on the floor. In the games that really mattered. And I think I got a little too low on his regular season impact, which, what a great innings eater, man. Mm-hmm. Takes the toughest assignments, keeps wear and tear off our bucket getters. Great, you know, personality in the locker room. Works really, really hard on his game, you know, by all accounts. But, does he have, you know, this next year is kind of the famed kind of leap year for most guys, like when they kind of show who they're going to be in the league moving forward. And I don't think he's got to be great, but he's got to get better, because right now, just right now, assuming Colin Sexton is back and the rest of the roster is as is, I don't think he's in the playoff rotation. And I think that even though, like, at the fifth overall pick, you really want him to get there, just based on that pedigree and based on what he's shown in spurts. Like, we did see the 3-point jumper in very, very low volume start to go in. He found his spot, the right corner.
Yeah.
But like, it needs to be something that you can actually count on if you want to be able to play him in the postseason, because being a good perimeter defender against the best players in the world who can make tough shots on you all the time, it only goes so far, especially if the Cavs, by the way, are going to keep trying to try to play this switch heavy style against elite creators.
Yeah. And another lesson from the playoffs, like, you look at Marcus Smart, who won Defensive Player of the Year. Kyrie still put up 39 points, and he was primarily defended by Marcus Smart. And I think I've seen that sentiment many times throughout the season, where there have been games where Okoro has shut a guy's water off completely. Like, he did
He won them some games last year. He did that to Kyrie,
in fact, right? Like, where he shut down Kyrie, and Kyrie was dapping him up after the game and giving him praise post-game, saying, hey, he really put in work. But the reality is, the elite offensive players will still get buckets on you. And you look at Marcus Smart, and at that age, very similar profile. Not a lot of counting stats. The jumper wasn't there at that point. The playmaking wasn't there. Like, just a really raw defensive player. The evolution for Marcus Smart wasn't just, okay, I'm making the defense what a hammer had on it, and that's what I'm bringing to the table. It's finding how to make impact in other ways, whether it be playmaking, the occasional three-point shooting. He goes through hot and cold stretches. And I think Kobe Altman, in his year-end press conference, framed it the right way, where they need to work to unlock Isaac Okoro, to get his skill set to the level where it matches his basketball IQ. Because I think his basketball IQ is really, really high. You see him make some really smart passes and really good reads when he's in control. But I feel like it's very similar to Garland early in his career, where he's trying to be part of the team. He's trying not to rock the boat. And until I don't think that's it.
I'm going to push back on this. I think it's straight up skill set. I think it has very little to do with his mentality. It has everything to do with the fact that the handle's not there yet and the jumper's not there yet.
It's very possible. And I think he recognizes what he can and can't do, and he's trying to fit into the team. Now, it's probably somewhere in the middle, and there's only so much we can kind of glean from watching on League Pass or on Bally Sports. Like, but ultimately, like, you look at it over the course of the season, and I think if you show like these percentages to us at the beginning of the year, we'd be happy with it. His field goal percentage increased by 6%, his 3-point percentage increased by 6%, and his free throw percentage increased by 5%. Like, all across the board, it was up. The volume's just basically identical. Like, you look at the per 36 numbers, he averaged 10.7 points both seasons. That feels That's impossible. Hilarious. The blocks, 0.4 both seasons. Steals, one steal a game per 36 both seasons. Assists, separated by a fraction of a percentage. Like, across the board, it was the same production on lower volume. And
I've said this a few times. Oh, sorry, you're finishing your
point. Yeah, I was going to say, if you can take the improved efficiency that he took and unlock it a little bit and increase the volume, I think that's a very good thing. But before you go, Carter, there was a great question asked to me. Forget who asked it on Twitter, but they were asking, do we want to see him increase his volume if Colin Sexton is back? If we run back the same roster and bring in another draft pick? And my answer is yes, in the minutes that he's playing. Now, it might not be like a massive volume, but even if he's coming in off the bench, if he can bring a little bit of playmaking juice, a little juice off the dribble, bring a little bit more of a dynamic element to his game, that's very valuable in the minutes he does play and is going to give him the best chance to compete for minutes, because ultimately the Cavs are probably going to be bringing back a roster full of guys that deserve minutes, and they're all going to have to compete for those minutes for the most part. So I think he would better position himself to be competitive for those minutes should he improve those skill sets. And number one on my list would be ball handling.
Yeah, I mean, it's, the answer is an unequivocal yes to that question. You can't be a high-level playoff wing with a usage of 12%.
Yep.
When you have no gravity. His true shooting percentage skyrocketed this year, man. It was 51 last year. It's 59 this year. But when your 3-point rate is going so far down, it's really, really challenging. It dropped by about 2%, which really does matter when you shoot it as little as he does already. So I just think, like, you know, we just want to see it. And we've said this a lot with him, that this is all so unfair because the guy was drafted to be a project on offense on a team that wasn't supposed to be any good for a couple years. Because even if they had, like, we were hoping this year would be the show a lot of promise year.
Yeah.
Not the try to win games right now year. And so while Isaac is still pretty much on the curve I was kind of expecting him to be on, the team's curve went up exponentially. So now they're saying, hey, Isaac, I know how we said that you had some time. You don't have time. We need you to be good right now.
And
that's really, really challenging and frankly, like, a little unfair to the guy. So, you know, I'm going to continue to be patient with him. But, like, the reality is until his – and that's why I didn't say, like, can Isaac Okoro prove he belongs in the league? Because I do think he belongs in the league.
He's going to be in the league for a long time.
Like, but I think the 16-game player is the next challenge for him. Because the reality is when it gets really, really tight, we kind of found he wasn't quite ready yet, at least in those two play-in games. So maybe over a course of a series, it would have played different. That goes back to my first question of what lessons does Kobe Altman and JB Bickerstaff want to learn? Because you don't have to decide on a 2-game sample size that he's not a playoff player.
Yeah.
But, like, that's where I am right now, and I'm very interested and excited to see him prove it.
Honestly, like, if I had to pick an archetype for him to study over the offseason, it would be Andre Iguodala. Like, I would love for him to
be... I was thinking PJ Tucker. You actually really sold me on the PJ Tucker thing.
The PJ Tucker thing was for Lamar Stevens. Calm down.
Oh, it was. You're
right. Yeah. I think, like, 6'5", Andre Iguodala, where, you know, the 3-point shooting comes and goes, but provides that little extra bit of ball handling, playing with a point guard or a primary ball handler, but someone that can provide that secondary playmaking that fills in the gaps, like, that has the impact beyond the stats. Like, that would be the archetype that I would like to see from him, because I'm assuming if Sexton and LeVert are back, I have a hard time foreseeing Okoro being the starting two next year, but I do think that there is absolutely a role for him. And I know everyone's going to pencil in. If they do draft a rookie, you'll draft pencil them into the rotation no matter what. But at the end of the day, like, that's a 14th overall pick going on to a team with expectations. It's likely going to be in a very similar situation to Okoro, where your opportunities are going to be a little bit limited given the goals that this roster has.
Yeah, it's going to be really, really interesting to see how he finds his way to minutes. Now, as we've talked about, like, every year feels like we're like, oh, the Cavs have a lot of guys. And then, you know, three of them get hurt and they're like, oh, we don't actually have that many guys. And, like, so, like, no matter where these guys go and kind of who is in on the team, who's in the rotation, who's out of the rotation, you're going to get your shots to get minutes and stay there. But it's going to be a challenge for him, especially as the rotation shorten in the postseason. Can I do my last question next?
Go
just
for
to
it.
Just to break up the rhythm?
Yeah.
My third biggest question, and maybe in a way the most important of them, is Evan Mobley going to take a leap in year two? Or is he going to, you know, just gently progress his game?
Allow me to fire myself a little bit. I haven't even begun to imagine what an Evan Mobley leap would look like next year.
Yeah, I mean, so here's the case for why it might not happen. First off season, he's exhausted. He's probably going to relax a little bit more compared to heading into year three when his body is more used to the grind. He's still going to be a kid next year. It's not like he's going to, come in with a man's body in year two. It's just not traditionally the curve.
Mm-hmm.
So I think a lot of his leap next year will be based on skill development, he shot 25% from three this year. If that's 5 percentage points higher, that is a meaningfully different amount of points scored over the course of a season.
Especially if it correlates with a higher free throw percentage.
Yes. The free throws were tough this year. Mm-hmm. That's one thing no one really talks about. You look at I think it's more likely that the Omega leap comes in year three. I'm actually coming into this next season, expecting pretty much the same Evan Mobley with a little teensy bit of refinement. But
growth
buddy,
in the margin, similar yeah. to what we were hoping for with Jared Allen, right?
Yeah. But buddy, if he comes out and is like hitting floaters and running pick and roll and hitting his corner threes, and just a little bit bulkier like that, I feel like it was funny, Darius was the ceiling raiser going into last year where we're like, Darius is the guy who will decide whether this team is going to be pretty damn good or not. Evan is now the guy who will decide if this team will be great or not.
I think that's true, especially long term.
And I don't think it's going to happen next year, but if it does, we got a stew going.
We absolutely do. And the thing that's really encouraging to me, and again, this is fan propaganda hour right here, Carter, but the fact that almost all these guys that we've brought in improved throughout the season, and that's one of the hardest things to do, and they've all seemed to make these offseason leaps. Like, it's consistent that they both improved during the year and they improved during the offseason, and I'm excited to see what the extra motivation over how this year finished, how much that adds to the equation, because I really am really, really interested to see what kind of growth we get from these guys. And we were expecting growth within the margins with Jared Allen, and I think he exceeded that. Like, I think the
100%,
the scoring he showed, like the footwork in the post, like the finishing, like that, those were elements of his game that I didn't expect to come.
I didn't expect to ever see them. To be honest,
it was at such a refined level, and that's really, really exciting. And if whatever work he put in over the offseason gets put in by Evan Mobley, who is by all accounts a perfectionist and another one of these workout warriors, that means a lot. That is going to make a big difference. And Mobley strikes me as one of those guys that the more talent you put around him, the better he looks, because he just has such a high basketball IQ and just such an understanding of the game. Like, the fit between he and Jared Allen does not work if Evan Mobley isn't as high IQ as he is. I think that's a pretty safe statement to make.
Yeah, I would agree. You can't normally play two bigs because they don't have the same feel for the geometry of the floor on either end, frankly, to be able to handle the scrutiny of the things you sacrifice by going big, which is spacing and foot speed. Now, obviously, mm-hmm. they're pretty damn fast for their size, but it's not like they're little water bug guards there. Like, they have to communicate, they have to be super smart and work beautifully together. So, yeah, I mean, I feel like people are forgetting that this dude's going to get way better over the next 4 years.
I'm pretty excited about it. It's so much fun. But for me, I have a different focus for next season, Carter. There's a different guy that I'm putting my focus on, and this is a bit of an emotional one for me. It's Colin Sexton. And my third question is, will Colin Sexton be back? And Sexton's a guy, for those that are newer to the podcast, that it took time for him to win me over. I was not a fan of the pick. I wanted Shai Gilgeous-Alexander or Mikal Bridges in year two. With Darius Garland and Kevin Porter Jr. being brought in, I thought that there was a succession plan in place where those guys would be taking it over. And Sexton eventually won me over. And obviously, the Cavs have to weigh all their options. There's probably more options and variables going into consideration than we will ever be aware of. But I would really like to see Colin Sexton back. And if I was spending the Cavs money, like, I would be offering whatever contract was on the table last year. I would still feel comfortable with that. And here's why. Because he came into the NBA as a player whose greatest strength was mid-range shooting. And throughout the course of his rookie year, he understood that my greatest strength is a bit of a liability. It's not as high impact of a shot. I need to improve my shot selection. And over the course of his rookie year, he developed a three-point shot and improved his shot selection. Coming into year two, Darius Garland comes in as the point guard. He's changing position. Really struggles and is pressing throughout the course of the second year. And then the team moved Jordan Clarkson. And from that point on, all of a sudden, he's playing better off ball. He adjusted to the new role incredibly well and finished the year putting up 24-4, essentially. The third year, even better, more refined, showed that end-of-season flash over the course of an entire season, and finished the year showing improved growth as a playmaker, especially like the easy reads in the pick and roll and that sort of thing. He showed growth in that area. Then coming into this year, he's playing off ball. He's from a two-point field goal percentage, best we've seen from him. He's dominating from a scoring standpoint without dominating the ball. His defensive numbers went up across the charts. Like, if you look at EPM, which has become my favorite catch-all metric, he was up in the 70th percentile defensively. I don't expect him to be there, but he's someone that has shown to be coachable and to make adjustments throughout the course of his career. And when you look at it, I don't think someone that put up 24-4 efficiently on a tough team, I don't think they become worse at scoring because they have more talent around them. He might not be asked to share that kind of a load, but given the buy-in that he's shown over the course of his career, he's someone that I would be willing to gamble on, because I think that type of scoring, what he can bring to the table, the efficiency, the buy-in, the effort that he brings, the no fear of making mistakes, that's a type of player that I think this team could really use. And you listen to Kobe in that press conference, he wasn't really hedging. There wasn't a lot of GM speak. Like, there was a lot of praise over what Sexton has brought to this organization. And I think that it's a gamble worth taking. I understand that there's areas of concern for me. While I like his on-ball defense, I think his off-ball defense is still rough. But at the end of the day, I feel like he's a player worth taking a gamble on, because what he can bring to the table in that level scoring is something that can really take this team to another level. And I think it's something that helps make Garland better, helps make Mobley better, helps make Allen better, because it does take pressure off of them.
I will take it another level, which is, I don't think it's a gamble. I think that you look at the things Colin did that this team really, really needed. He was a bit of an off-schedule, off-ball cutter in a way that would really throw things off. If you're watching on YouTube, you saw where the kind of plays where, you know, Ricky would have the ball at the wing and start dribbling at Colin for what looked like a handoff, and all of a sudden he'd just dart to a back cut baseline and just absolutely dust people. I remember rookie year Colin had all this speed and nothing to do with it. Yeah. He wasn't able to generate angles with his handle. He was often playing against with an unspaced offense. And so a lot of it was just him just running into the opposition. And, you know, for all the hand-wringing about moving him off ball from some folks, I think it's the number one way to make his speed, you're taking, you know, all the restraints off of him and just saying, go, be fast. Run in transition, and we'll hit ahead and get you the ball.
Look at Maxey, man.
Yeah, he was the best transition player on the Cavs this season, in my opinion. On a team that really doesn't like to run, Darius is not a fast point guard. In terms of they were a slow paced team. I think they were 30th in the league. And I think that, you know, a guy who can generate you cheap buckets with smart baseline cutting that doesn't get in the way of your too big lineup, and guys who can leak out and transition without, you know, compromising the shape of your team and the way you, you know, end possessions on the defensive boards, who can just generate an advantage, is so valuable. they missed his ISO scoring. I mean, you look at some of those highlights from just from this season, which wasn't that good of a season for Colin in the 11 games he played.
Yeah,
like it was a down year especially from a 3-point shooting percentage perspective. He can just generate decent looks better than most folks when plays break down, and you really did miss that this year. So yes, like I guess if you're worried about a cap number, if that's the business you want to be in, sure, it's a gamble. But like the reality is, Justin, this is a team that, as far as I can tell, does not seem to anticipate being a cap space team anytime soon.
Yeah.
The way that they are investing in players like Lauri Markkanen, Jared Allen, you don't think a big deal is coming down the pipe for Darius here pretty soon?
Mm-hmm.
So what am I losing?
Sorry to cut you off, but that was part of why you trade Ricky Rubio for Caris LeVert. Is you're not getting the expiring contract of Ricky Rubio, but now you have a contract that you can either choose to keep and retain the services of LeVert in whatever role you see fit. Or you now have that as a trade chip to match salaries. It's a large expiring contract for a player that can provide value on court, right? Like, you have flexibility in that way, and that's probably the way that the Cavs are going to have to approach team building. Like, I don't think that this is
going to... It's rolling contracts, and it's a really smart strategy when you're not a cap space team, because there's really not a good road for them to do that anytime soon.
And especially when, like, some of the guys that you might put into a trade that have value, like if you were at some point looking to move a Sexton or a Coro type player, there's just not a lot of salary there. So you would need a player to attach that with if you were to look to make a consolidation trade. So I think it is really smart from a flexibility standpoint, even though you are locking yourself into money. But I like, to me, the risk, or I guess the concern, is just from a health standpoint, right? Where he's coming off of an injury, but You look at the way that Sexton's approached everything, and the reason, like, when I said that I'd run back the same offer as last year, like, well, I'm not talking really from a money standpoint. I'm saying from a confidence in Colin standpoint, my confidence wouldn't be shaken based on him getting hurt this season. Like, I still think that is a player that you can believe in. I think that that's a guy that can really add value to this team. And that's where I'm interested. And maybe what happens is you run back a similar offer, and maybe it's a 5-year offer like what Jared had, and you put a player option on there. So there's some element of like betting on yourself or some sort of flexibility within there. So he has those kinds of options. Maybe that's the way that this gets resolved. But I really would like to see Colin Sexton back. And again, they're smarter than us. We've been right. We've been wrong a million times. Like, we've had emotional points where, like, moving on from Larry Nance is a great example. Like, that's a guy that was on the podcast multiple times that we enjoyed. But you ultimately have to act in the best interest of the team. And sometimes that best interest is in ways that we can't foresee in the exact moment. So I think this team has earned the benefit of the doubt. But if I'm evaluating all the variables that we have in front of us, I'd like to see him back. I really do believe it can work. And my confidence in Garland and Sexton working together is even higher now that I've seen that Mobley and Allen work together. Like, the four of them together had 100 defensive rating for the minutes that they did play together. And it was a small sample size, but if you're going to make that backcourt work, those two are a prime example of how you can make that backcourt work.
Yeah, he's awesome. I really hope to see him back. And again, even if you're not sentimental, even if you're not a fan, like, to the point that you made about rolling contracts, like, the worst thing you can do when you're a team like the Cavs, and we saw this happen to Boston for a couple years, and they've luckily just been able to, like, fight their way through it because they have two S-tier superstars,
mm-hmm.
In Tatum and Brown, but they were just letting guys walk.
Yeah.
And it really, really drains your ability to make meaningful moves on the periphery or of your roster when it's just constantly your talent pool is just draining and you're getting nothing back for it. Because when you're not a cap team, because, like, if you're a team that is projecting to have a ton of cap room and you can replace that talent, that's awesome. But if you're going to be up against that line in the first place, it's just so hard to let talent walk out the door. And you got to get lucky. You got to draft a Robert Williams or someone like that that all of a sudden looks like a legit great player for you. You have to, you know, you have to help rejuvenate Al Horford to fight your way out of that drain. So
that, and then even then, if you're not, you still have to give up multiple firsts and Josh Richardson and Romeo Langford or whatever other pieces they threw in there for Derek White. Like, they gave up a boatload of future assets and flexibility there. Like, it's not easy. And one of the things I've always been grateful for as my time as an adult Cavs fan here is that we haven't let talent walk because of money. Like, we've been really lucky from an ownership standpoint that way. So that's I hope to see that play out, but I'm really interested to see how that develops. And that is absolutely one of the biggest offseason questions. But one more before we get out. Carter, this is one that I'm going to throw at us because I've seen it on Twitter. Are the Cavs this year's version of the Knicks-Hawks, where the Knicks and Hawks last year obviously were pretty high in the standings? They surprised a lot of teams. They caught them off guard. Hawks made an Eastern Conference Finals run. And then this year, they had to really fight through it. And the Knicks would have made the play-in if they were in the West. I think the strength of the Eastern Conference was a big surprise this year. And the Hawks had to battle their way in and obviously take out the Cavs to make it back into the playoffs. Do you think that there's a potential for that type of scenario where the Cavs go from feel-good story that had it taken away at the end to struggling to keep up with an improving Eastern Conference?
No, I don't. I mean, here's the reason why you might feel that way. We were expecting, I mean, you were very on the Toronto is going to fall back train. They didn't. Philly is still in win now mode. Boston, Miami, Milwaukee, Chicago, all in win now mode. So your top six are all, no one looks like they're going to not try as hard next year as it currently stands. And then you still have Brooklyn, Atlanta, who look like they're going to still be trying just as hard next year. If not, both teams should be better than they were this year, just based on their pedigree and the talent level on their rosters. So that is why it might happen. Just because the East is awesome, which is still weird to say. But in terms of just like the overall quality of the team, I just don't think it's likely because of their youth. When the team was not very good, I just kept saying like the number one thing they need to do to get better is age. And like, they're going to keep aging. They're going to keep getting better. Like a team of 21 and 22 year olds shouldn't be as good as a team of 22 and 23 year olds. Yeah. They are, the dependence on Kevin Love is, you know, like as he ages and his career, you know, winds down. I guess that would be a thing you would point to, like, because he had an awesome year and led the team in games played, which remains ridiculous. But like, I just think like they won because of their kids that are showing a ton of promise. So why would I think that it would fall off? I just don't think they're that kind of team. Now the Hawks are their own thing, but that's a team that was supposed to come back fat and happy. You know, it makes sense that they came back fat and happy. They made the Eastern Conference Finals. That's ridiculous. And then the East got really good around them and they got a little less lucky with health and all that fun stuff. And then things kind of turned the way they did. By the way, how many teams in the Cavs played 70 games or more?
How many players on the Cavs?
Yeah.
None.
Just Kevin.
That makes sense. Yeah.
How many players played at least 60?
Four?
Seven. Evan played 69. Darius played 68. Nice. Jesus. Okoro only played 67. It does not feel like that dude missed 15 games. Jetty played 66. Lamar played 63. Lowry played 61. Jared only played 56. Dean Wade only played in 51. Windler somehow got into 50 games, which that seems impossible.
That actually is one of the most surprising stats that's ever been thrown at me. I'm sure, Carter, we got to let our audience off the hook because I'm sure everyone's holding their breath to see if I believe if the Cavs will fall back next year.
I'm sure it's really up in the air.
It can go either way, man. It really could. I don't, and I feel intellectually consistent with the fact that all of last year I was screaming that it was a fake season. People were playing in empty arenas and unbound schedules. The Knicks had unprecedented good luck on wide open opponent threes where those shots didn't go down. Julius Randle was shooting like Steph Curry. Like, it was such a weird year and such a fake season that the regular season was tough to account for. Like, Boston got hit with more COVID than any other team. Jason Tatum had to use an inhaler the entire year because of how sick he got. Like, it was just such a weird year that the Knicks, I mean, there was a reason why everyone thought, hey, there's a very good chance this team comes back down to earth, because you look at like how they were winning and it just didn't make a lot of sense that it would carry forward.
Their best player was a career fifth man.
And Atlanta was basically the same team they were last year, where, remember, a third of the way through last season, we had Brad Rowland on the podcast talking about how the Cavs and Hawks basically had the same record. And after that point, they got a little bit healthier. They had good continuity, and they moved up to the 5 seed. But this year, Chicago went in on adding a bunch of players. Cleveland improved a bunch. Toronto no longer pulled the plug. Toronto was a playoff team last year, and I thought they might pull the plug on Pascal Siakam this year. Like, that was a lot of my reasoning, and hey, maybe Scotty Barnes is the succession plan there. They didn't. Toronto got better, and they surpassed them. Boston surpassed them. Cleveland surpassed them. Like, I think Atlanta was the same team they were last year. The rest of the conference just improved around them. And you look at the results last year, it was just a very, very weird season. And this was a much closer season to a typical NBA year. It was 82 games. I think we shouldn't discount the fact that a lot of players on the Cavs played an 82-game season for the first time in their careers. That's now something that they know what to do to prepare for. And they weren't playing a 60-game season like they did in the past, or the weird condensed year that last season was. Like, I think this regular season is way more reflective of what these teams are. And the other encouraging thing to me, it'd be one thing if the Cavs took the easy part of their schedule, got fat on wins, and then got hurt through the tough stretch, and we don't really know if they would have lived up to expectations as the schedule got harder. That's not the way it played out. They went through the toughest part of their schedule and were within a half game of the number one seed in the Eastern Conference. And when things got easier, that's when they fell apart from a health standpoint, where they didn't get to, their starting five didn't get to play a single game together after the All-Star break. Those are indicators to me that this season is more legitimate than some people want to give it credit for. And I understand that key veterans like Ricky Rubio and Kevin Love played massive parts in their success. I think that's going to be something that they'll need to make sure that they're addressing, whether it's with bringing Kevin Love back or bringing in another veteran ball handler. But at the end of the day, like, the amount of internal growth you can expect from the Cavs, I think, is a little bit different than a Knicks team with RJ Barrett, who is projected for internal growth. But outside that, it's like a Nerlens Noel, Julius Randle, a bunch of 28-year-olds that won with experience and defense in a tough, weird season where nothing was normal. Like, I think what we saw this season is much, much more sustainable.
Can I ask you, if the Cavs win 43 games next year?
I'd be disappointed.
You would be disappointed.
Yeah.
Or 44 games, sorry, what they won this year.
I
wouldn't be disappointed. I think that there's a lot of different roads to 44 wins. I think if they win 44 games but have a plus 5 or 6 point differential as opposed to a plus 2, you know, and we see them be, you know, consistently great and able to, you know, overcome some of these injuries a little bit better, not let the wheels fall off. Mm-hmm. I think there's still a road to a successful season, because, like, the reality is, like, I just don't think they're ready to be a 50 win team. I think that's what this stretch showed, unless they make some, you know, bigger splashes on their roster, because otherwise I just don't think it's going to be that linear. I don't think they're just going to keep flying up the standings. And I think fans should ready themselves for another 40 win season.
I would like to get above 45. Like, I would like to be in the high 40s next season is what I have in mind. Like, I think when you look at it right now, with the extensions that J.B. Bickerstaff and Kobe Altman had, this is a 5-year plan. That was year one of a 5-year plan, where you're anticipating having some stability there. And I think by the end of the 5 years, you would hope to be at that contender level, given the assortment of young talent they have. You're right that it's not going to be linear throughout that process, but unless there's just brutal injuries, and we get more season-ending injuries next season, I think that this team should be taking a step forward from a win-loss perspective, regardless of the context around them, because as good as Eastern Conference was, they were up there with a lot of those teams. They did a very good job this season, and I expect them to get better, especially if some of these questions we asked, if the answer is yes to some of these, like, yes, they're bringing Colin Sexton back. Yes, they're looking to improve the small forward position. Yes, they're looking to address some of the holes from a depth standpoint. If the answer is yes to some of those questions, I would like to see, maybe 50 is unreasonable, and we don't know how competitive the rest of the conference is going to be, but I'd like to see high 40s. I think that's a realistic expectation going in blind, not knowing what this offseason is going to bring.
Here is the other case for this, by the way, is just how stinking old the Heat are. You know, that's a team who is relying on two 36-year-olds and a 32-year-old. To be some of their key rotational pieces that they're still going to be paying next year. By the way, didn't it feel extra crazy that Kyle Lowry is making like $28 million a year? You know,
it's a
like
choice.
I think
it's a choice, man.
But you know, and then Philly, you know, we don't know the direction of Harden, but even the Bulls, like, they're Levine is a free agent, I believe, or
yeah.
something.
Yeah, approaching he's an unrestricted free agent.
And DeRozan is old. DeRozan very well might be hitting, you know, he might be the kind of guy who loses a step and falls off. So, like, there is a road to it. I just think I'm going to be happy if they can match their win total, but do it a little cleaner.
Yeah. I just have such a hard time swallowing that, but there's so much that goes into that, and we'll need to see what it looks like. I think that's the best way to frame it, because maybe the Eastern Conference looks a little bit more like the West this year, where it's a little more top heavy. There isn't as much parity throughout it. And like 48 wins gets you the sixth seed or something along those lines. Like I think
it was also a remarkably healthy conference. If you think about it, I mean, Miami lost players for stretches, but they never got absolutely decimated. Milwaukee lost Brooke Lopez, that's whatever. Boston kept the Jays were healthy most of the year.
Honestly, like,
Embiid played a ton of games.
I'm gonna push back a little bit. I think the entire league was really banged up. Like, you can talk relatively, but like, Toronto missed a ton of games, but they were still like bottom three, I think, in total games missed. Like,
I'm comparing to the West, to be very clear.
Oh, okay. I thought you were saying just overall.
You look at the Nuggets, you look at the Clippers, you look at the Lakers. I mean, I know that we hated that roster, but they're certainly not an 11 seed talent-wise, even with that garbage around them, just because AD played like 15 games and LeBron missed like 25, 30 games this year. It was crazy. Zion didn't play a game. So, like, you look at just the wattage of star power that missed significant time in the West that made it easier to be top five, top six, and compared to the wattage of star power that missed time in the East, I don't think it's comparable. And maybe the Cavs get a little bit luckier next year with that. Who's to say?
Yep. I think that's a fair point. And there's going to be a lot that goes into it. I think they're in a really interesting position. I think this is going to be a fascinating offseason. I don't feel the same pressure that we did last season to make a big splash. Like, I think running it back in some ways would be a splash if you make the little tweaks here or there. I agree. I think I'm not as adamant as you that it needs to necessarily be a center. But if it's a power forward that plays defense and sets screens, I think that can work. Like a Brandon Clark type.
A center to me. Like, you know, he's a power forward slash center, and he's as much of a center as a power forward. How good was he in that freaking win, by the way? Oh, he's awesome.
The Canadians, they showed out, Carter. They showed out in that game, and it warmed my heart, especially in the clutch. Yeah, and I mean, from a health perspective, maybe Memphis gets more gains out of Ja Morant next year, and they take a little bit of a step back as a result. You never know how that's going to go, but we will certainly be here to cover everything that happens this offseason as you shake your head at me. I deserve that. Hopefully everyone listening live on YouTube, you're also shaking your head at me. I like to bring out emotions out of you people. But if you want to support the podcast, make sure you like, subscribe, click the notification bell so you know when we're going live. If you're listening via podcast, leave us a rating, leave a review, subscribe, unsubscribe, resubscribe, and help cook those books. If you want to be part of Chasedown's exclusive Discord chat, you can send a screenshot of that review to chasedownpod@gmail.com. However you choose to support us, we really do appreciate it. Make sure you guys are staying safe out there. Until next time, go Cats.